a 9% default rate. This figure has just surpassed the peak seen during the 2008 financial crisis, not just nearing it, but exceeding it. Last quarter, U.S. private credit funds received $13 billion in redemption requests, but how much did they actually pay out? About $8.4 billion, leaving $4.6 billion of investors' money locked inside, unable to get out. BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, saw investors ask for $1.2 billion back but only returned $600 million, that's half. At Apollo Alternative Assets, for every dollar investors tried to withdraw, they only got 45 cents. A fund managing $33 billion saw investors demand 14%, but it only paid out 7%. The doors are locked. That's not the news. The real news is what happened after the doors were locked. A hedge fund sent a letter to retail investors trapped in private credit across the US. The message was simple. You can't get your money out, so I'll help you, for a 70% discount. A short-selling research firm published a report called The Myth of Hercules, accusing a major tech lender of picking projects by simply opening Google Ventures website and copying whatever they invested in. They have $1.5 billion in software loans. While the rest of the industry is discounting similar debt, they are still marking theirs at par. The moment the report dropped, their stock price plunged 8% in a single day, and a securities class action lawsuit followed immediately. Those inside are crying, those outside are scavenging, and others are shorting the people who locked the doors. A brand new food chain is emerging from the ruins of private credit. If you are a longtime viewer of this channel, what I'm about to say will resonate with you. Over 3 weeks ago, I produced the first episode of Wall Street's Hidden Lines to tell you about the $2 trillion private credit market, which at the time, almost no one in the Chinese-speaking world had explained systematically. Many saw the title and thought I was peddling anxiety. Then, I made a second episode about five doors closing simultaneously, and people in the comments were still saying, oh, clickbait again. 3 weeks have passed. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell spoke at Harvard on March 30th and said four specific words. Watch it super carefully. The head of the Fed is now watching this market. On March 27th, the U.S. Congressional Research Service released a specific report titled Private Credit, Redemption Restrictions, Market Context, and Policy Issues. Congress is watching it too. If you still think this is peddling anxiety, I suggest you leave right now. This channel's content isn't for you. For those staying, let's continue. This episode of Wall Street's Hidden Lines isn't just an update, it's an upgrade. In the first episode, we talked about what this is. In the second episode, we talked about how it's accelerating. Today, in the third episode, we discuss the ecosystem reorganization after the doors close, who is scavenging in the ruins, and who is hunting those who close the doors. Does this have anything to do with the index funds you bought? Does it have anything to do with your 401k retirement plan? And why will this problem only snowball from here? Everyone, get ready. Let's take a quick break. Speaking of those who arrive first after the doors close, you might not have heard of the name Saba Capital. It is a hedge fund, and the person behind it is Boaz, a Wall Street credit trader known for striking when others panic. You can simply think of them as the vultures of the financial market. When others run, they enter, and when others sell at a discount, they step in. On March 6th, the day before our first video was released, Saba and another firm called CX Capital jointly announced a tender offer for a fund under Blue Owl. Remember Blue Owl? We talked about it in the first episode, the company that literally welded the redemption doors shut, with its stock price down over 60%. That company has a private credit fund for retail investors that invested in 183 companies, with a total value of $1.6 billion. What price did Saba offer? $3.80 per share. The net asset value of this fund is $5.69 per share. If you do the math, $3.80 divided by $5.69 is about 67%. In other words, Saba is offering you 67 cents for every dollar of your assets, a discount of over 30%. Blue Owl's board of directors, of course, was up in arms. On March 13th, they even issued a statement unanimously recommending that shareholders reject the offer, arguing that it is far below what we consider the long-term value. The board also promised to return more than 50% of net assets to shareholders by 2026, implying, don't worry, I'll pay you back slowly. If it were you, what would you think? You are a retail investor locked in a fund. You can only withdraw a maximum of 5% of your money each quarter. Assuming you invested $100,000 in 2023 and you apply for a redemption, you get $5,000 back each quarter, then another $5,000 the next. But don't forget, last quarter many funds couldn't even meet that 5% requirement. At this rate, it might take you 3 to 5 years to get everything out. No one knows what will happen in the market over the next 3 to 5 years. Can you afford to wait? At this moment, if Save walks up to you and offers 67 cents in cash on the spot, do you take it? 67 cents might sound like a loss, but if your only alternative is a redemption-restricted fund where you don't know when you'll see that theoretical value of $5.69, then the certainty of 67 cents might be worth more than the uncertainty of $5.69. That is the business logic of Sixth Street. They aren't betting on what the asset is worth, They are betting on the level of panic and the liquidity premium. When everyone is looking for the exit itself becomes the most scarce product. Sixth Street isn't selling assets, they are selling the exit. And Sixth Street isn't just targeting Blue Owl. In an interview, Winston mentioned he is closely watching Cliffwater, that $33 billion fund requesting 14% but only paying out 7%, saying, "That is the one I am watching most closely." This means if the Blue Owl acquisition goes smoothly, the next one could be Cliffwater, then Morgan Stanley's fund, and perhaps even more. This isn't a one-time operation. It's the birth of a new business model. You might think this practice is unfair, taking advantage of others' distress to reap low price gains, but there's a saying on Wall Street: someone else's panic is your profit. During the 2008 financial crisis, the Paulson Fund made $20 billion shorting subprime CDOs. At the time, people called it profiteering, but later, it was written into business school textbooks. What Sixth Street is doing is the same: buying when others are forced to sell, profiting from the liquidity premium. Here you might naturally think, if a major institution like Sixth Street is willing to put real money into acquisitions, doesn't that mean these assets aren't actually that bad? If everything were about to collapse, they wouldn't step in, right? That line of thinking makes sense, but it's only half right. Sixth Street entering is indeed a signal. They are voting with their money, saying, "I believe what I bought for 67 cents will eventually be worth more than a dollar." From this perspective, they've injected a bit of confidence into the market. At least someone believes the underlying assets won't go to zero. But you must clearly see that their way of making money is completely different from yours. You are a retail investor who bought at face value, so you need the assets to return to face value just to break even. Sixth Street entered at a steep discount. So even if these loans are eventually only worth 70% or 80% of face value, Sixth Street still makes a profit. You lose 20% or 30%, while they double their money. The same asset, the same outcome, yet you lose and they win. The difference is the entry price. So, vultures entering the scene doesn't mean it's over. It means someone thinks there's still meat on the carcass. But the vultures are the ones eating, not you. The offer expires on April 24th. How many retail investors accept the 67 cent bid will itself be a thermometer. If a large number accept, it means confidence has collapsed. If most refuse, it shows the market still believes in the value of the underlying assets. But Apollo isn't the only one who smelled blood in the water. There's a lot of information here, so if you find it useful, feel free to like and save it. We talked about picking up carcasses at the bottom of the food chain. Now let's talk about hunting big fish at the top. On February 27th, an organization called Hunterbrook released a short-selling report. This firm is quite unique, a hybrid of a media outlet and a hedge fund. They write investigative reports with one hand and short stocks for profit with the other. It's controversial, but their reports are often very revealing. The report's target is Hercules Capital, which we'll call Hercules. It is one of the largest tech-focused private credit funds in the US, specializing in lending to tech and life sciences companies in Silicon Valley. Their report is titled The Hercules Myth. The title is blunt, and the content is even more so. The first accusation: a former analyst who worked at Hercules told Hunterbrook that their method for finding investment projects was to open the Google Ventures website, see what Google's VC arm had invested in, and just copy them. Just imagine this scenario: a public company managing billions of dollars in loans claims to investors that it has a strict five-step investment review and approval process. In reality, the entire staff is just online copying homework. The second accusation: about 35% of Hercules' loan portfolio is invested in software companies, which is one of the highest concentrations in the industry. As we mentioned in the last episode, AI is disrupting the software sector, and billions of dollars in industry-wide software loans have already fallen to discounted levels. However, Hunterbrook found that Hercules' $1.5 billion in software loans are still valued at 100 cents on the dollar. While all their peers are offering discounts, they are still marking at full price. The third accusation: Hunterbrook interviewed a member of Hercules' former finance team, who said that the team responsible for valuing the multi-billion dollar loan portfolio consisted of four people. You heard that right. Just four people. Think about what that concept means. The company publicly promotes a five-step valuation process where every loan is board approved, but in reality, four people are handling the pricing for billions of dollars in assets. These four people are responsible for covering 183 companies, spanning two completely different industries, technology and life sciences. Each person is responsible for an average of nearly 50 company loans. A typical BDC of this size would have a team of a dozen people or more. The whistleblower stated that the team is understaffed and the review process is inadequate. Often, it's just a formality. During the earnings call on February 12th, the CEO was still claiming that their foundation was built on rigorous lending and underwriting discipline, but 3 weeks later, the Hunterbrook report shattered that foundation into pieces. The fourth accusation, which I find the most fatal, is that an increasing portion of Hercules' income is being generated through PIK. We've mentioned PIK before, which stands for payment in kind. It means that when a borrower can't afford cash interest, the interest is added to the principal to pretend it was paid. It's recorded as income on the books, but not a single cent in cash is actually received. The Hunterbrook report uses a very direct term, ghost income. Once the report was released, Hercules' stock price plummeted nearly 8% on February 27, and things snowballed from there. A securities class action was filed in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California on March 20. The law firm representing the plaintiffs is well known for handling securities fraud litigation. The class period covers May 2025 to the end of February 2026, with a deadline of May 19, meaning that over the next 2 months, more investors will join the lawsuit. This whole thing is just getting started. Now, if you put these two stories together, Saba is at the bottom buying up trapped shares from retail investors at a 70% discount, while Hunterbrook is at the top shorting the funds holding these bad loans, digging up evidence, and writing reports to trigger lawsuits. One is buying, one is selling, creating a squeeze from both ends, and these two actions are causally linked. The short report panics more investors. If redemption requests rise, the funds become harder to exit and more people get locked in, making Saba's discounted buyouts more attractive to those trapped, leading more people to accept the lowball offers. Market confidence drops further. It's a self-reinforcing cycle. If you have friends around you who have bought private credit products or hold stocks in alternative asset companies, forward this video to them. What I'm about to discuss concerns everyone investing in the US. You might say, Saba and Hunterbrook sound exciting, but they're targeting specific companies. What does that have to do with an ordinary person like me? I haven't bought any private funds, right? I buy Vanguard Index Funds or Fidelity 401(k)s. Those should be safe, right? Let's start with the conclusion. If you're buying a standard S&P 500 index fund, like SPY, your money isn't at risk there. Index funds track publicly traded stocks, which is a completely different world from private credit, so you can rest easy on that front. But being safe doesn't mean being entirely unaffected. The impact is indirect and is transmitted through three main channels. The first is the stock prices of the management companies. Blackstone, KKR, and Apollo are all publicly traded companies. If you've bought a financial sector ETF like XLF, or certain actively managed funds heavily invested in these names, you have indirect exposure. These firms have each fallen around 25% year to date, with over $100 billion in total market cap wiped out. If your funds hold them, your returns are being dragged down. The second channel is tightening credit conditions, which is a much more hidden path. Private credit funds borrow to leverage their investments from major banks. Think JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs, which provide them with leveraged loans. When banks perceive rising risks, they tighten lending standards, not just for private credit, but for the entire credit market. Once credit conditions tighten, it becomes harder for small businesses to borrow, leading to a decline in economic vitality. This transmission isn't something you'll see overnight, but the direction is quite clear. The Federal Reserve noted this specifically in its March 27 report. Private credit funds rely on bank financing, and if forced to sell assets for cash, they could tighten overall credit conditions. The third channel is the one that worries me the most. The Trump administration is preparing a new regulation to allow private credit products into 401(k) retirement plans, which is an $11.5 trillion pool of capital. If this rule passes, by late 2026 or early 2027 at the earliest, private credit products could start appearing in your retirement plan. You might not even know it, because many people's 401(k)s are automatically allocated. If you don't actively check, you'll have no idea where the money went. Fidelity is already building model portfolios that include interval funds and tender offer funds. If your financial advisor has chosen this type of portfolio for you, you may already have private credit exposure. You just don't know it yet. What's really concerning is the timing. This new regulation just finished White House review. Note that at the very moment the private credit industry is experiencing its worst redemption crisis in history, the government is opening the doors of retirement plans to it. Industry critics put it well. This isn't about growing retirement savings. It's about helping alternative asset managers find new buyers to take over, because retail money is fleeing and they need fresh capital to come in. Okay, regardless of your political stance, there are concrete steps you can take right now. Spend 5 minutes doing three things. First, open your 401k or brokerage account and search for three keywords: private credit, BDC, and interval fund. If you find any, check what percentage they make up of your portfolio. If the allocation is small, say 2% to 3%, you probably don't need to be too nervous. The impact of this individual size on your overall return is negligible. If it exceeds 5%, read the product's redemption terms carefully. Check if the quarterly redemption cap is 5% or 10%, and whether the fund has the right to suspend redemptions. These fine prints that no one usually reads will now determine how quickly you can get your money out. The second thing is to check if your funds are heavily invested in the stocks of alternative asset management companies. Actively managed funds disclose their holdings every quarter. For example, if names like Blackstone, KKR, or Apollo are in there, you are indirectly bearing the impact of their stock price declines. This doesn't mean you have to sell. It means you need to know where your exposure lies. The third thing is, if your financial advisor is recommending any high-yield, quarterly redeemable products, ask them three questions. First, what are the underlying assets? Second, what is the redemption cap? Third, what happens if redemption requests exceed that cap? Once you ask these three questions, you'll know exactly what they are selling you. There is an analysis from Moody's that I think is very spot on. It says that if you hold the most common diversified funds, in the long run, even if private equity runs into trouble, you are highly likely to be safe. Tightening credit will cause market volatility, but volatility does not equal permanent loss. What you need to do is not panic sell, but rather understand what you own, how much you have, and what the exit terms look like. I'm not saying you need to sell everything immediately. I'm saying that not knowing whether you have this exposure is the biggest threat. Having resolved the question of whether this affects you, let's go a layer deeper. Why do I judge that this problem won't disappear anytime soon? It's not just one issue weighing on private equity right now. It's four issues appearing simultaneously, and they are feeding off each other. The first one is interest rates. Short-term interest rates won't come down. Powell made that very clear. Inflation remains stubborn, and with the war in Iran driving up oil prices, the market has pushed rate cut expectations to the end of the year or even next year. The interest burden for mid-sized companies with floating rate loans won't lighten. Paying extra interest every month is slowly draining their cash reserves. The second weight is AI. As mentioned in previous videos, private equity currently has about $500 billion exposed to software companies. The impact of AI on traditional SaaS is not just our speculation. Hercules Capital's lawsuit explicitly states that 35% of their loans are in the software sector, and similar industry-wide loans have fallen to distress levels. The trend of AI replacing software subscriptions will only accelerate. JP Morgan issued a warning last month that the default rate for private credit in the software sector, where AI impact is most concentrated, could soar to 8%. What does 8% mean? Historically, the average is only 2% to 3%, and the software industry is not a small niche. It accounts for about a quarter of the entire private credit market. When the default rate for a quarter of the market triples or quadruples, it drags down the numbers for the entire industry. Look at what has happened in the past 6 months. Once AI coding tools emerged, outsourcing demand for writing code for software companies plummeted. Once AI customer service went live, companies no longer needed to spend hundreds of thousands annually on customer service systems. AI writing, design, and data analysis. Every AI product launched is stealing renewal clients from traditional software companies. The moat of software companies has always been considered high customer stickiness and high switching costs. AI has reduced those switching costs from 3 months to 2 days. The moat is still there, but the water has dried up. Once renewal rates drop, the ability to repay debt becomes an issue. Problems arise, but funds are unwilling to mark them as defaults immediately, so they use PIK notes to hold on. As the proportion of PIK rises, the true default rate is masked, and investor confidence is built on inflated numbers. When it can no longer be hidden, the adjustment will only be more severe. The third weight is the maturity wall. $470 billion in private equity loans will mature between Q3 2026 and the end of 2027. Maturity means refinancing or repayment. In an environment of high interest rates and shrinking software valuations, refinancing terms will be much worse. Some companies might not be able to refinance, and if they can't, they default. This $470 billion is not spread out over 10 years. It is concentrated and maturing all at once within a year and a half. Let me run the numbers for you so you can see the scale of this pressure. A mid-sized software company with $50 million in annual revenue took out a $20 million floating rate loan in late 2021. Back then, the benchmark rate was near zero, so its interest rate was maybe around 5%, costing $1 million in interest annually. Now that the benchmark rate is above 5%, its interest rate has jumped to 10% or even 11%, resulting in over $2 million in annual interest payments. For a company that wasn't making much profit to begin with, interest expenses have doubled. If AI then poaches some of its customers and the renewal rate drops by 10%, that's $5 million less in revenue and $1 million more in interest. Can this company survive? And this isn't just a hypothesis. Among the 30 borrowing firms tracked by Fitch, the vast majority that defaulted were smaller companies with annual profits of less than $25 million. That is the exact profile. The fourth point is that IOUs are ballooning. The industry average for PIK income has risen from 6.1% a year ago to 8.2%. It's basically ghost income. Let me put this simply. Suppose a company borrows $1 million from you at a 10% interest rate, so you should receive $100,000 in interest annually. But they say, I really can't come up with the cash today. How about you add the interest I owe you to the principal? So I'll just owe you $1.1 million instead, is that okay? Quote, you agree, So you record $100,000 in annual revenue on your books. Investors look at it and think it's great. The fund is still making money, but in reality, you haven't received a single cent. You've just received a larger IOU. The second year, the company doesn't owe $1 million. It owes $1.1 million. The interest is calculated on $1.1 million, so it becomes $110,000. They might still be unable to pay cash, so the IOU grows to $1.21 million. Year after year, the IOU gets bigger and bigger, but your cash flow remains zero. That is PIK. It isn't a default because the contract allows it, but it causes the default rate to be severely underestimated. Companies using PIK to pay interest are, at the end of the day, unable to pay. They haven't officially defaulted yet, but once they hit a wall and can't pay, they won't be able to sustain the PIK either. These hidden bad debts will all surface at once. The higher this number goes, the more borrowers are just hanging on with IOUs. The average is 8.2%, but some funds might be at 12% or even 15%. You wouldn't know, because funds can choose not to disclose the PIK ratio until the full financial report is released. So, even with a 9.2% default rate already exceeding the 2008 peak, the true pressure is still being underestimated. Plus the portion hidden by PIK, the actual situation may be even worse than the numbers on paper. Four factors combined: high interest rates draining cash flow, AI cannibalizing software revenue, mandatory debt rollovers at the maturity wall, and PIK masking actual defaults, create a quadruple spiral, where each exacerbates the others. With rates staying high, it's harder for firms to pay debt. With AI shrinking revenue, they can afford it even less. When the maturity wall hits, they are forced to roll over. If they can't, they default, and the previous PIK interest, which only pretended to be paid, all surfaces. This is why I don't believe this issue will disappear within a quarter or two. Because these four problems aren't parallel, they are in series. To resolve this spiral, you need to solve at least one of these four things, right? Either interest rates drop significantly, AI's impact suddenly slows down, the maturity wall gets pushed back, or PIK accounting practices get cleaned up. Currently, I don't see any of these happening in the near term. Rates aren't dropping, Powell said so himself, as inflation remains stubborn. AI won't slow down. On the contrary, its commercialization is accelerating, as we see every day. No one has the power to push back the maturity wall. It's written in loan contracts. PIK regulation is tightening and the SEC is investigating, but regulatory speed is always slower than the market, so all four spirals keep turning. Goldman Sachs analysts predict that the private credit market could shrink by $45 billion to $70 billion over the next 2 years. The industry took 5 years to grow from $50 billion to $220 billion, and now it may give back a third of that in just 2 years. Redemption requests for large BDCs managing over $1 billion are up 217% year over year this quarter. Not 21%, that's more than double. The Fed chair is watching, Congress is issuing reports, and the former PCO co-chair is comparing these risks to 2008. Now look at the other side. The bears might enjoy hearing this, but the bulls shouldn't leave yet. This part is for you. Some investors see through this situation, and what they see isn't a crisis, but a once-in-a-decade entry window. First, you must understand a counterintuitive fact. The private credit industry will not disappear. On the contrary, as bank regulations become stricter, it means more mid-sized enterprises must seek non-bank financing. Projections suggest this market could reach $4 trillion by 2030. The issue right now isn't the asset class itself, but the semi-liquid packaging created over the past 3 years to sell to retail investors, packaging illiquid assets as liquid products. The shell might be shaky, but the loans inside that shell are still being repaid normally by the vast majority of borrowers. Blackstone's periodic fund has delivered an annualized return of 9.8%. This is not a Ponzi scheme. Furthermore, every credit crunch in history has created a batch of unfairly beaten down assets. And those who bought these beaten down assets ended up making a fortune. After 2008, funds that bought discounted mortgage-backed securities saw their returns double or even triple over the next 5 years. During the 2020 pandemic panic, Oaktree Capital bought a massive amount of high-yield bonds at the bottom, many of which later returned to par value. The logic is the same. Panic creates discounts, and discounts are the source of excess returns. Blue Owl sold a $1.4 billion loan portfolio in February to four North American pension and insurance companies. According to reports, the price was close to par value. If those loans were truly as bad as the media claimed, pension funds wouldn't have stepped in to buy them. Pension fund investment committees are staffed by actuaries or risk experts. Their move proves they conducted their own assessments, concluding the underlying assets aren't as scary as they look on paper. Third, short selling itself is an evolutionary mechanism. Hindenburg's shorting of Icahn Enterprises, regardless of their motives, objectively forces the industry to improve transparency. The era of four people managing billions in valuations may be coming to an end. The short selling pressure will force higher disclosure standards, and the SEC is already investigating private valuation practices. This is painful in the short term, but good for the long term. Only a more transparent industry can attract smarter capital. So, if your timeline is long enough, not just this quarter, but 2 to 3 years, There are three directions to watch. First, discounted BDC shares. Once the bottom fishing prices from this wave of SVB come out, there will be a reference benchmark. Second, funds specializing in distressed debt are the natural beneficiaries in this sector. Third, the winners after industry consolidation. Large platforms will absorb smaller ones, and advantages in management capability and capital costs will concentrate in top-tier firms. But this window isn't today. We are still seeing bleeding, and you don't bottom fish a patient still in the trauma unit. You have to wait for the bleeding to stop and for valuations to fully reflect the risk before it's the right time to enter. I estimate that will be, at the earliest, in the second half of this year or next year. To summarize my current assessment in one sentence, it is not 2008, but it is definitely not just normal volatility. This is the first systematic test for this asset class, and the test isn't over yet. It depends on what is written on those pages in the April financial reports. I know the comment section will surely be split into bulls and bears. The bears will say that the default rate has already exceeded 2008, so how can you call it anything other than a crisis? They'll say PIC has covered up so many bad debts, and when the April financial reports come out, it will surely explode. The bullish camp also has its reasons, saying you are manufacturing panic, pointing to Blackstone yielding 9.8% and pensions stepping in to buy, meaning the underlying assets aren't that bad. Both sides have a point, and both are stating facts. The default rate has indeed exceeded the 2008 peak. These are Fitch's numbers, not something I made up. But in 2008, it was over $10 trillion in mortgages deep on every bank's balance sheet. Today, it is less than $2 trillion in corporate loans, with direct bank exposure around $320 billion. The scale is different. PIC does indeed have issues with concealment. That is also data. But private credit funds have a 5% cap designed to prevent bank runs. The money market funds of 2008 didn't have that protection. The structure is different, so I won't draw a conclusion for you. What I am willing to do is present the evidence from both sides and tell you that April is when the answers will be revealed. At that time, we will let the numbers speak, not me. In the middle to latter part of April, various BDCs will successively release their first set of complete financial reports. The numbers you see now, $13 billion in redemptions, a 9.2% default rate, $4.6 billion locked, are all data points from the redemption side. Having said that, what you see now is just how many people are lining up to withdraw money. But the ledger hasn't been opened yet. Only on the day that ledger is opened will you see how much these funds have actually shrunk, how much income is real cash flow, how much is just pretend IOUs, and how many loans have actually gone bad but haven't been acknowledged on the books yet. At that point, things will be priced as they should be and written down as necessary. Everything currently hidden by PIC and delayed valuations will be brought to light. After that, the second quarter redemption window will open immediately, and the SAW acquisition is also due on April 24th. These events will all collide within the same month. To be honest, I don't know what will be written on those pages in April. It could be better than expected, a stress test of fear that the industry withstands, or it could be worse than expected, accelerating the spiral and closing more doors. I really can't say for sure, but I do know that no matter the outcome, you will see the breakdown on this channel the moment it happens. In the very first video, I said, you cannot manufacture liquidity from an inherently illiquid asset class. That was a warning. 3 weeks have passed, and that warning has turned into a live broadcast. They've arrived. The hunters are here, the lawyers are here, and the annual reports have started opening up. The quadruple spiral is still spinning. Furthermore, the money waiting to be sent in, the $11.5 trillion in 401 kiloseconds, might be more than the money trying to squeeze out the door. This story is far from over. As the saying goes, retail investors knock but the door stays shut. 30-cent bids are coming in fast, defaults have broken the 08 line, and April's ledger will be even more dramatic. Tell me your judgment in the comments. How far will this round of adjustments ultimately go? Do you think we should buy the dip after the April earnings reports, or is it better to sit on the sidelines for half a year? Share your reasons. I want to see what everyone is thinking. I may, remember to like and subscribe after watching, and I'll see you in the next video. Why?